A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Welcome to A Tempo, the Classical Network spotlight on the arts and culture. I'm Rachel Katz, and I'm your host for this journey into issues facing the performing arts. Each week, I'll bring you some of the latest news and also take time to examine many of the issues these organizations are facing. Today, we'll look at the topic of leadership, a timely issue with election season in full swing, through a musical lens. American composer Victoria Bond, a few years back, created the opera Mrs. President, based on the story of the first woman U.S. presidential candidate, Victoria Woodhull. More recently, she has created an oratorio called The Reluctant Moses, which examines that leader's hesitation about taking on a pivotal leadership role. I'll speak with Bond about these works and her plans for other projects depicting leaders. As part of A Tempo, we're pleased to bring you some of the news from around the world of the performing arts. Opera fans this week mourned the loss of Peter Allen, the voice of the Metropolitan Opera radio broadcasts for nearly 30 years, who passed away October 8th. According to the New York Times, Allen hosted more than 500 Saturday afternoon performances, a run that ended in April 2004 with a performance of Wagner's Götterdämmerung. According to the Times, Allen, a violist, began working in radio in Ohio, became an announcer at WQXR in 1947, and took over for the previous opera host, Milton Cross, in 1975. Allen was 96. And for the first time in history, a musician has been awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature. Singer and songwriter Bob Dylan, whose works include Blowin' in the Wind, was credited by the Swedish Academy, which awards the prize, for having created new poetic expressions within the great American song tradition. An article in the Wall Street Journal cited praise from former Oxford professor Christopher Ricks, who put Dylan in the ranks of great poets, including Keats, but also pointed to criticism by those rankled by what they viewed as his use of others' words, including authors such as Jack London, and also questioning whether there may be other musicians who should have been recognized first. The 75-year-old Dylan will receive the award at the ceremony scheduled for December 10th. Those are just some of the headlines this week from around the arts world. With election season now in its final month, the topic of leadership and its qualities has been a major focus of conversation, discussion, and debate. So it seemed appropriate to examine some recent musical compositions looking at the trials and tribulations of leadership. This past summer, Victoria Bond premiered one of her latest works, an oratorio examining Moses and his initial foray into leadership. The work, The Reluctant Moses, was performed by the Choral Society of the Hamptons at Old Whalers Church in Sag Harbor. It focuses on Moses' encounter with God at the burning bush and his hesitation at taking on this mantle of leadership, despite the divine request. You just heard the opening of the work. It's not the first time Bond has delved into the topic of leadership. Her opera Mrs. President follows the 1872 campaign of Victoria Woodhull, a suffragette who was the first woman to run for the U.S. presidency. Unconventional in many ways, she faced her share of detractors and found herself in jail on election day. The work, with a libretto by Hilary Bell, was first performed in concert in 2012 by Anchorage Opera. Scenes from the opera will be performed at the National Opera Center in New York later this month. I spoke with Bond over the summer about these works and their examination of leadership.
I was particularly drawn to the moment when Moses hears the voice of God for the first time in the burning bush, and God asks him to lead the Israelites out of Egypt. And Moses says, I'm not qualified. I'm not worthy to do this. I'm not a good speaker. I'm not a natural leader. Please find someone else. Now, having had situations in my life, numerous ones, when I was asked to or expected to do something that I did not feel qualified to do, it was a very familiar sensation of saying, not me. And the more people I spoke with, practically everyone said that they had had similar moments in their life. So I felt that it was kind of a counter image of Moses, who is always portrayed as the great leader and powerful and knowing exactly what he was doing. I thought it was particularly pertinent to have this moment of indecision and humility, really, before the great deeds that he did later on.
Well, like so many Bible stories, you know, very often a story is based on sometimes just barely a few sentences, a few verses. How did you then build more into the story to create a solid oratorio?
Well, the implications in the as you say, slim text, the biblical text or the Torah as it is, really do give an indication of Moses' character. Number one, God argues with him. And I think this is probably the only time in either the Torah or the New Testament where God actually argues with a human being. And he presses Moses' reluctance and he says, look, I'll show you these miracles. Throw your staff on the ground. And the staff becomes a snake. As of course, in the Ten Commandments, this only happens when Charlton Heston meets the Pharaoh. There's absolutely nothing that happens at the burning bush. It's very disappointing. But in the Torah, this actually does happen at the burning bush. So Moses throws his staff down. And musically, it was very fascinating for me to think of putting the audience in Moses' sandals, as it were, and to see an inanimate object just barely move. And it's like, did I really see that? And then move a little bit more, and then take on this, you know, this violent motion of a snake hissing and squirming. And Moses is terrified. And God says, put your hand back on it, and it will turn back into a staff. So he's trying the first miracle, and it doesn't work. And Moses says, yes, but will they really believe me? And so God tries the second miracle and the third miracle, which are both turning water into blood and turning Moses' healthy hand into a hand covered by scabs and scars, and then turning it back into a healthy hand again. And through all of that, Moses says, yeah, but when I talk to the people, will they believe that I really talk to you? So he's terrified. He's stubborn and he's terrified. And the miracles that God provides are really not enough. And finally, when Moses says, how will I know what to say? How will they believe me? Who will I say spoke to me? And God gives Moses his name. Now, the name of God, as you probably know, is a very sacred thing in the Jewish religion, and you are not supposed to actually say the name of God. There are all sorts of substitute names, but God does give Moses his real name, and he also says, don't worry, I will lead you, I will go before you, and I will put the words in your mouth. So finally, Moses relents. And of course, in the Torah, we bring Aaron into the picture at this moment. But I didn't want to sort of muddy the waters. I wanted it to focus only on Moses and not on Aaron. So I just kept it that Moses did finally agree to lead the Israelites out of Egypt. And then I have a little coda. Well, it's not so little. It's a long coda because I heard a voice in my head say, you're going to set the Ten Commandments as a four-part fugue. And I thought, no, I can't do this. I'm not capable of doing this. And I realized that's exactly the point of my piece, is to take an assignment that you really think you can't do and to just jump in with both feet and do it. And I did it for better or worse. So there, the coda is all of the Ten Commandments set as a fugue. I don't know how I did it, but I think I had help. The other thing that I wanted to say about this piece is that I wrote it in honor of my father and my grandfather. My father being a bass singer and my grandfather being a double bass player. And so the voice of God is the voice of the chorus because it's multi-gender, multi-ethnic. It's as diverse as possible. But the voice of Moses is both the bass voice and the double bass as kind of the subtext to the text.
Well, I did want to ask for a little more detail about how you explored this musically. You mentioned the bass voice side of it. What else did you bring into it to add to the story and to work and reflect off the story?
Well, I actually used a trope, actually several tropes that are in the Bible. A friend of mine is a cantor, and she gave me a trope that is used for the word God, but it's, as she explains, it's not the God trope. There, no such thing exists, but biblical scholars know this. The tropes are used more as a point of punctuation, rather than a leitmotif in a Wagnerian sense. But I just found this particular melodic, rhythmic motif, is the best I can call it, very, very appealing. And because it is thousands of years old and does come from the original chanting of the Torah, I used that as my as the voice of God, really, that particular melodic motif is associated with God. Ba-dee-dee-dum, ba-dee-da-da-dum. That's basically it. And I did it in lots of different variations.
What are some of the other lessons and themes you wanted to impart to the audience through this?
I wanted to put them in Moses' shoes, sandals, as it were, because I think what music can do is that it can speak directly to the emotions. When we read the text, it has an intellectual appeal, and of course that can translate into emotions as well, but I wanted this to be visceral. So when Moses first hears the voice of God from the burning bush, it's whispered. I wanted to use the S sounds, and Moses, of course, is a wonderful word to use, like the hissing of flames. So I have the chorus all whispering, Moses. Moses, Moses, in different rhythms, so that it would sound like the flickering of flames. That was actually the first inspiration for the piece. And then after that, when God says, take off your shoes because you're approaching holy ground, then the voice of God is huge and imposing and terrifying and awe-inspiring. So God has many voices. Sometimes it's the women who are singing, sometimes the men, sometimes it's mixed. It's, well, you know, there's one line in Amadeus that always appealed to me, even though we know that it's not completely historically as Mozart really was, but there is one line that I think is directly from Mozart, and that is, he says, I want to hear the way God hears, which implied the entire world, maybe the universe, all at once. And it was that sense of the multiplicity of voices that was one voice, that was one creator or creative force.
Well, the premiere was in the Hamptons earlier this summer. What was the response like?
Oh, we had a great response. We had a full house and a beautiful setting of the historic Old Whalers Church in Sag Harbor. The chorus was in the balcony of the church, very sort of San Marco, antiphonal chorus, one on either side of the stage. On the stage was the orchestra and the soloists, and I had two absolutely divine soloists, John Feeney on bass and Joseph Charles Butel sing as the bass singer. And they were extraordinary soloists, and I had a chance. I went to school with the bass player, with John Feeney, so I knew him from before, and the bass singer, Joseph Butel, was just absolutely fabulous. I couldn't have asked for better soloists. And the orchestra was extraordinary. Mark Mangini was the conductor, and the chorus did a terrific job. So I was very, very pleased.
Now, what are your plans for expanding it? I understand right now it's a smaller state. You'd like to see it grow a little bit.
Yeah, it's about 20 minutes, and I'd like to make it into a 30-minute work. There are several sections that I want to expand. The whispering section was very successful, but it takes a while for people to actually be able to hear the whispers. So I'll probably expand that to twice its length. And then there's a section between the coda and the section before that, when Moses does agree to God's request. And that I had a kind of a orchestral interlude of the shofar, and I heard the shofar echoing from in a canyon, echoing from place to place, so that you hear multiple shofars, as it were. And I liked that section, and it was really rather short, just because I knew we had very little rehearsal time. So I'd like to expand that. So I think from a 20-minute to a 30-minute work will be good.
Leadership is such a rich material in literature and opera, whether it's Hamlet, whether it's in other great operas. What makes this such an attractive topic to write about musically?
Well, I don't know if I would take that as an abstract. I did write about leadership in my opera, Mrs. President, because it involved a woman president, which was, and dare we say, still is, something that's not taken for granted. Women in leadership in particular are not taken for granted. So it was in the context of a woman president that I really wanted to explore the issue of leadership.
Jumping off that, of course, now you wrote that several years ago. It's had some performances, and now we are in a year where we have another female presidential candidate.
Hallelujah.
How is that, or do you see any of the themes you reflect in the opera Mrs. President coming out and being part of this election cycle?
It's, as a certain sportscaster said, déjà vu all over again. It's really amazing. I have been watching with bated breath the conversation, and the moniker devil applied to Hillary Clinton is verbatim what they called Victoria Woodhull when she ran in 1872. The Hearst paper dubbed her Mrs. Satan, which was the original title of my opera, but when Hillary was making moves to run for president, I decided that I did not want to cast aspersions on her campaign and to make it seem as though I was calling her Mrs. Satan. So we changed the name of the opera to Mrs. President. But in the Hearst paper, Victoria Woodhull is portrayed with horns on her head, and they're not Moses horns, and black wings, and underneath the picture it says Mrs. Satan, and she was considered a threat to society, a dangerous woman, somebody who must be stopped at all accounts. So many of the lines that they are saying about Hillary Clinton are almost verbatim what was said about Victoria Woodhull in 1872, more than 140 years ago. So I think that art is imitating life, is imitating art, is imitating life. I mean, it is astounding to me that in 2016 we are still fighting the same battle.
Well, I understand there's at least one production scheduled for the fall. Do you expect to see additional interest in more productions of the opera?
Absolutely. I think it's an opera for our time. It's never had a fully staged production. It had four scenes read by the New York City Opera. It's had a concert performance with orchestra by the Anchorage Opera, but it's never received a fully staged performance. So on October 28th at Opera America, we're going to present several scenes from the opera and hope to stir the pot again and get a producer interested in mounting a fully staged production, because it's very dramatic. I mean, there is a scene where I'm sure you followed the Republican National Convention, where they were yelling, "Jail her, jail her." Well, there's a scene in Mrs. President where they yell, the crowd that's come to hear her speak, "Mrs. Satan for president," and she does get jailed on election night, 1872. Victoria Woodhull was jailed. So I think that having this staged will be so timely and so dramatic. I wanted to paint the last scene in Mrs. President, where Victoria Woodhull is in a prison cell. That's the way the opera ends, and it could be a very depressing moment. And it starts out that way because everyone has abandoned her. Her husband, the financial backing that she had a seat on the New York Stock Exchange, her best friend, everyone has left her, and she feels so alone. But because she was a woman of such enormously strong character and such vision, she says, "No, it's not over. Arise, arise from my ashes. Women will come and take my ideas and move them forward." And in the, even though it was not staged, in the production that we, a concert production with the Anchorage Opera, women politicians stepped out of the wings and walked through the audience. And it was such a tangible fulfillment of her prophecy that the audience went crazy. It was really, it was her prophecy that even though she did not get there in 1872, she foretold that other women would come and pick up her ideas of women's equality. You see, it was much more than just women getting the vote. The suffragists kind of abandoned her because she went so far beyond what they were demanding. She wanted complete equality for men and women. And her vision of that and of a woman president, way beyond just women getting the vote, was kind of outrageous to them. But she was outrageous, and that was what attracted me so strongly to her. Here was a woman who couldn't even vote, and she foresaw that a woman would be president. Pretty remarkable.
Well, remind us just briefly what her background had been and how she wound up not just being, as you said, a suffragist, but someone seeking that highest office.
Excellent question. How did she get from being a poor child of a kind of a snake oil salesman father in Homer, Ohio? How did she get to run for president? Well, as I say, she was a remarkable woman. She had a vision that Demosthenes, yes, the ancient Greek Demosthenes, told her she should go to New York, meet Cornelius Vanderbilt, and start her her process. And she did. She and her sister Tennessee Claflin, I mean, these were two hicks with no education or background, but she was very self-educated, and she surrounded herself with very brilliant people. Most of the men were very supportive of her. And she met Cornelius Vanderbilt as a kind of a joke. He set the two of them up on Wall Street with a seat on the stock exchange. And lo and behold, they were very clever. They made money. And that's how she bankrolled her campaign. In addition to her Wall Street connection, and excuse me, there's another similarity to Hillary Clinton, and it was not a negative at that time to be associated with Wall Street. In addition to that, she started a newspaper, Woodhull and Claflin's Weekly, by the way, the first newspaper to print the Communist Manifesto, pretty advanced for the time, and that was her mouthpiece. So she had money, and she had a public forum. And coming from the background that she did, it's astounding and awe-inspiring.
Any other leaders you're interested in pursuing through your works in the future?
Well, actually, I did a four-president, putting together a four-president CD. I've always loved Lincoln Portrait, and I love the format of it, which is having narration and musical, more than an accompaniment, a musical partner to the narration. And it all started with George Washington, because I was so impressed with him, because he turned down absolute power, which was handed to him on a silver platter, and I dare say we could not find a politician today who would do that. So I was very impressed with Washington. In addition to, and I've been working with a writer, Dr. Miles Lee, who's also an historian, and put together a script in the same way that Sandberg put together the script for the Lincoln portrait, incorporating Lincoln's own words. Dr. Lee incorporated Washington's own words. And in addition to narration, I wanted to feature a solo instrument and to draw upon music of the period. So, for example, with Washington, as I say, the first, I used fife and drum tunes from the Revolutionary era as the source material, and the solo instrument is solo flute. Thomas Jefferson is chronologically the next one, and Jefferson himself played the violin. Even though he didn't play in public, he did play just about every day for his own enjoyment. And one of the pieces in his library, La Folia, I used as the, quote, found object and built a violin concerto around that. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, not chronologically the third, but the next one, I used a clarinet as the solo instrument and based it on big band music of the 1940s. And the last one, which will be Theodore Roosevelt, which is the piece is completed and we're going to be doing the recording next spring. I've written a trumpet concerto, and Mark Ridenour from the Chicago Symphony is going to be our trumpet soloist. And that will be for brass ensemble and trumpet. And that'll be the fourth one. And all four will be released on Albany Records. You know, our founding fathers and some more recent founding fathers, even though they have feet of clay, and yes, you can say all sorts of negative things about practically every one of them, they are very inspiring because their vision and the best of what they left us is on such a high level. So I wanted to celebrate the great works of great men and forget about their follies, shall we say.
That follows in the success that we've been seeing with Hamilton.
Hamilton, exactly. We need heroes, and these people are definitely heroes. And we can't think of heroes like gods to be perfect. Well, even the Greek gods were anything but perfect. We need to accept the totality of who they are, faults and warts included.
That was my conversation with composer Victoria Bond, followed by an excerpt of the performance in Anchorage of Mrs. President, featuring soprano Valerie Bernhardt. You can find more information about Bond and the October 28th performance of Scenes from Mrs. President at the National Opera Center at mrspresidenttheopera.com. If you enjoy A Tempo and other programs of the award-winning Classical Network, remember they're only possible with your support of this station. If you haven't yet become a member of the Classical Network, please make your contribution this month during our Procrastinators Amnesty membership drive. Simply go to wwfm.org and click on Donate. Thank you for being a member of the global listening community that is the Classical Network. Thank you for joining me for A Tempo. I'm your host and producer, Rachel Katz. An archive of recent shows can be found anytime at our webcast page at wwfm.org. Join me next week for another look at the changing world of the performing arts. A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is supported by the listener members of the Classical Network.